learning how to interact with a wide array of people. People who are balanced, to people who are unbalanced, to people who are obnoxious, to people who are kind, to people who are violent, and people who are toxic, and people who are not, and getting along with everyone. Enough.
You had this accent from New Jersey.
What accent?
Yeah, the songs you have to play.
Songs,
yeah. How, again, at what age did you stop having this?
I don't actually know for sure. I think it was around age 7 when I changed school. So I was going to a public school just across the street from the house I grew up in. And then I was having trouble in that school. I wasn't flourishing. And my brother had started going to a private school a couple years before that. And so my parents thought that maybe I needed to change schools as well. And they asked me, you know, I wasn't really engaged in the teaching. And I was kind of in my own little fantasy world. And I was...
So you were just like... being a kid,
yeah,
like imagining and having fun, like, yeah, not like basically in trouble or something like
no
this,
not
like,
at all no yeah. No, I wasn't doing assignments, I wasn't really engaged, I didn't really find the school very engaging.
Okay.
But there were some things I really liked, and they asked me, like, what do you like? And I said, well, I love art class, visual art class. And we had a teacher who was kind of, well, he was pretty eccentric, kind of 70s kind of eccentric fellow, and big bushy beard and glasses, and probably did a lot of drugs and God knows. And anyway,
beard's always a giveaway.
That's a giveaway. It's trouble. Spot. So the school, they made this arrangement to get me extra art class. So I got extra art classes and started, but the classes were with like the sixth graders, and I was like a second or third grader. And I was terrified of them because I thought, you know, they're bad teenagers and they're gonna corrupt me. And I was terrified of older kids. And
corrupt you to do what?
Oh God, smoke cigarettes probably.
Oh my.
Or listen to rock music. Okay. That was the worst.
You had a specific music you liked at the time, which was not rock music.
No, I was actually writing little songs that I would call my songs, and I had a
lot
of
the songs you wanted to share were what you wrote, actually.
Okay. I wrote little songs when I was
when
a
you
child.
Were in grade 2.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was a kid. I had this fantasy of becoming a pop star and having like an album with a soft focus picture of me on the cover. And it was sort of, it would be very kind of, I've never told anybody any of this. I don't know how you got that. It's sort of pop, kind of 70s sort of ballad, kind of pop song, like breathy, sort of tuneful. Anyway, and I was into that, and yeah, so I wanted to do art, and... But that didn't work, so I went to a private school. I auditioned a few different schools. I went to a private school, and when I started going to that school, I started speaking like the other kids who were from different parts of Jersey, and they weren't really they didn't have the New York connection maybe that my family did, so I lost the accent.
Okay. Yeah, I also had an accent when I came to Canada, so I was very Indian typical kind of way of speaking until about grade 6, 7, 8, and then... Yeah, you, how do you say, integrate with the kids, and then you start speaking the way they speak, and now I talk like this. So. But it's cool to still have, I like that you still have it with you, and you don't seem ashamed of it or something.
Oh God, no. Yeah. My partner, he says it comes out when I get mad. And
please give me an example.
I don't know who they think they are. Like, what? Sort of.
Okay.
Yeah, I was driving. It's like, they have no idea. You get really, you know, nasal.
All right, it's cool, because it's tied to some, like, you get into your fundamental, you know, when you're in this angry state, and that's it. That's how it comes out. It's kind of funny that that's your channel.
I have these fantasies when I'm in traffic of some obnoxious driver coming up behind me and doing something horrible, and I'd be like, I get out of the car like, you want a piece of this asshole?
Nice.
Anyway, I
have
didn't
you
ask you
have you ever done that
profanities
your don't worry, don't worry. Yeah,
I haven't.
You're too zen or something.
Well, I have, I think, some kind of executive control or filter that kicks in. It's like, okay, don't. Yeah, because that kind of thing can just go bad really fast.
Yeah.
It's amazing how quickly you can lose control of a situation just by not having that break.
Yeah.
That sort of emergency break to kick in.
Yeah, in some ways, a lot of what we've talked about earlier about just like kind of feeling free and doing your own thing, like do you think this is the same mechanism that, like, we talked about it in the context of like conforming to society, let's put it this way, and so this break, is that part of that, do you think, like does it also?
Yes, and it can be a problem actually. I mean, because you can sometimes put it on when you don't need to, and you know, the break can get overgeneralized so that you stop yourself, you filter yourself, you censor yourself, so you subjugate yourself even when you don't have to, and in fact maybe you shouldn't, but you do it because you're afraid of, say, conflict or you know, getting rejected or getting into trouble or making someone disappointed or angry at you, as opposed to what it really is for, which is just survival and not, you know, getting into a kind of a gunfight with a crazy person
on the road
in an F-150.
Yeah.
Those are different, but I think there is a tendency, I think, to maybe over-apply it.
Yeah.
My life has always been this process of trying to learn how to be judicious and not filtering too much, but also, you know, not understanding my environment so that people can understand where I'm coming from.
Do you have a way of I mean, you said it ties to your environment. Do you have a way to express like where the line is between you know, this executive, would you say faculty or executive?
Yeah, filter, whatever. Or executive.
This fancy word, executive, to like stop yourself from yelling at some random people on the street versus just like inhibiting yourself to conform. Like, do you have a way of describing that where it's?
I think it depends on the context. It depends
context
on the environment.
And
I think it also depends on the outcome that I'm trying to achieve. Because I've kind of learned over the years that you need a kind of, you need to be a little bit strategic in how you, where you place that line, because it isn't fixed. It isn't a rigid placement. It can be moved depending on who you're with. If I'm in an environment that I know is full of shit disturbers and they're okay with being feisty, and I know that.
So these are people who challenge the status. What is this?
Yeah, this is I would say people who don't feel overly concerned with conformity generally.
Okay, they don't care what other people think, and they're just like, I'm gonna do my thing. And
I think so.
Okay.
If I'm in an environment of people that I know don't care so much or not overly caring about what other people think, then I'm going to be more, I'll feel freer.
Yeah.
But that's not really where I circulate very much. You know, I tend to be more in environments that have very pretty rigid codes, a sort of very highly formed, codified systems of how you have to act. They have. It's like everyone kind of silently agrees to how you're going to be and what are the rules of being and what kind of things are okay to talk about and what kind of things shouldn't you, and, you know, and every environment I'm in has a different code. So I've gotten kind of good over the years at kind of sussing out, kind of reading the room, depending on where I am. So knowing how safe or how dangerous this place is going to be to say this or that. And to find a way to kind of move through that environment without causing too much trouble. And then I have to decide, like, how much skin do I have in the game? Like, do I, is this an environment where I, it's important to me that something change or that someone think something differently than they do or think about me in a certain way or give me access to something or another resource or, yeah. you know, and then depending on that, I have to understand that certain ways of engaging them are going to work more than others. And so that's what I mean about being strategic. I mean, and then there's some environments where I'm just, you know, it's just interpersonal and that it's that there's no kind of
filter.
Transaction.
Yeah.
So I don't need to worry about it.
We've talked in the past about your efforts to push against, you call it sometimes consensus reality or just maybe even getting people to think differently, etc. And there's different ways you might have tried to go about this. Why do you feel called to
Why do you have to do that?
Yeah, I mean, you could also just get in line and do what everybody else is doing. And that's not necessarily even a bad thing, maybe sometimes. But anyway, you feel called to try to notice what's happening and maybe, as you say, decide when it makes sense to change the way that somebody might think. And maybe sometimes it doesn't make sense to do that. But why do you feel compelled to do something like this?
I don't even think I feel compelled. I think it's just who I am. I think it's like almost just like how I'm wired up. I'm wired up to one friend, colleague of mine long, long ago, like nearly 30 years ago, and said to me, "You're really good at spotting naked emperors." And so that was like one of the best compliments I felt I had ever been given from someone, because it was just, it's just the way I am. It's that I see things that don't add up, things that don't make sense to me around me, whether it's some belief system that's entrenched in people, behavior that seems inconsistent with words or actions that aren't consistent with words.
Contradictions.
Yeah. Contradictions, rhetoric, rigidity, myopia, like not seeing clearly, and people being horrible to each other, and all of this being, and that being a normal thing and something that I'm supposed to play along with, it doesn't make sense to me. And so I've always, it's just been something that I feel wired up to counter. And it's almost like a, It kind of is a nourishment. It feels a little bit like a nourishment for me, like eating.
Okay.
It's like it sustains me to counter contradictions, to try to push against them.
Yeah, in some respect, contradictions are just part of being human, and everybody has
them,
and we all just they're a part of us, but. I think you're trying to work against the ones that maybe can just have some sort of kind of bad secondary consequences. Or
well, I don't make any kind of calculated decision. Oh, well, I'm going to be someone who acts against this. It's like I don't make a decision that I'm a person who does this. I've always been impressed by people who think of themselves in those terms, that almost seem to be able to describe themselves from this place of being outside of themselves, and sort of as if they were watching someone, a character on stage, and they were like describing who that person was to someone else. It's always been interesting to me that people seem to be able to talk about themselves in that way, and I've not been like that. I've never really thought of myself that way. That's why an interview like this it's a very strange experience for me, because I don't really decide that I'm going to be this person, or that I'm going to do these things, or that there's this injustice that I need to speak out against.
Nor have I framed you as a specific person yet. So, I mean, we could talk about what you actually do for a living, but...
That's true.
Yeah, but later.
Okay.
Unless you want to share, I don't know. Like, what do people know you for?
I'm a musician. I'm a teacher. I'm a university professor. But that's about 20% of who I am, to be honest. And I mean, work to me fits into an experience of living. And so my life with animals and sewing and bonsai and gardening and trees and nature and reading and learning about esoteric, mystical traditions, spiritual perspectives, healing, all of this is a huge part of who I am.
I really wanted to ask you about how you got into sewing, because I feel like, I mean, of course, like, my connection with you is very much associated with music, because I studied in this school that you were teaching at, and I was one of your students, and yeah, it's hard to just shake that. And I've learned more about you since we've hung out after I graduated, so I'm aware of these other aspects of you. But this is just kind of a surprise to me today. I mean, you made this wonderful shirt, and like, you have this dungeon here where you work on your sewing stuff. Like, how did you end up with this?
This is this journey of such pain and anguish and frustration. There's nothing, I think, more difficult that I've ever attempted in my life than this. It's been over 15 years of just toiling in the kind of in between moments of living my life as a professional, and you know, it has nothing to do with anything, but just it's just pure creative discovery and learning from the total ground zero. My partner and I rented a house in 2009 that had no curtains anywhere. We were moving from a place like an apartment into this house. It was a big kind of house, and lots of windows and absolutely nothing to cover them. And we were like, well, we don't really have money to buy curtains and blinds, and like, it's going to cost a fortune. So we thought, well, why don't we buy a sewing machine and just get some fabric, and I'll learn how to make curtains. So I just started sewing like 50 panels and I learned on the job. I mean, it was this, the necessity of having to make these things. And so I made these curtains. I was like working in the middle of the night in this place and sewing and like, and I mean, really making hamburger out of a lot of it, just because I didn't know what I was doing.
Sure.
And I don't even think YouTube was invented back then. I couldn't even watch videos.
Oh, true, yeah.
I didn't even know. It was maybe just starting.
I mean, it's around, but not in the way we have today, with the library of the stuff. Yeah,
yeah, it was just not as easy to find instructions. And so I start. I made those curtains, finished them, and then I started making... I was like, oh, it'd be really cool to make, like, a shirt. Like, that'd be really cool. So I thought, oh, I'll buy a pattern, a commercial pattern, and then I'll start sewing. And I was like... So I tried this thing, and it was just impossible. And I made... It was, like, this disaster. And I was like, what? And the thing about... The thing that was so frustrating with this... my jersey's gonna come out... is these stupid instructions in these patterns that have... Okay, so every pattern that you buy in a store how to make something has this sheet of instructions. It's supposed to make it easier to do. But I didn't understand anything about... It's like, because you have... In sewing, you have, like, right and left, right? But you also have front and back, and you have the right side and the wrong side. So I would see in the instruction things like... attach the right side of the right side to the wrong side of the left side to the right side inside out, and then turn it upside down, and then stitch right sides together to the wrong left side to the right side of the right side, but not the right side of the left right side, but the right side of the right right. I was like, what the? It was so exasperating. You have no idea what this did to me. I was like, and Jeff, my partner, he's like, Kevin, you'd come up from the basement being, I can't stand this fucking thing. I was so totally overwhelmed by this. Never before had I had an experience of not actually thoroughly feeling just so thoroughly stupid. I mean, just so completely, like, I really could not understand this.
Well, how can you blame yourself?
Well, I thought, well, it should be easy, right? Because it's just sewing, right? It's just, and... I started to realize, you know, this incredible skill that it is. I mean, and seeing, you know, honestly, the sweatshops and this incredible garment this world of garment construction with these, you know, really talented people that no one ever realizes what it actually takes to make a piece of clothing.
Mm.
And just is incredible, just being shocked at how we just wear these things and we don't think about the people making them.
Disconnected from the process of how it's made.
Totally. Yeah. And the reality of the lives of the people making these things, and what you have to do to actually learn how to make some wear quickly, sort of ready to wear thing. So I started gradually getting into that, and then I found some books, and the books were really not much help because they assumed that I knew more than I did, so I found a teacher in Texas who was taught by distance, and I could send him pictures and questions, and I started gradually
via email.
Okay. Yeah.
This is 2000 under 2000.
This was sort of started around 2010-ish.
Okay.
And I started getting slowly better, and I started getting into sort of like how to draft patterns and how to make patterns and how to fit. So the real trick is how to actually fit. Like, constructing the garment is the last step, but there's like how to measure a body, how to cut the fabric. There's art in measurement. There's art in cutting. There's art in pattern drafting. There's art in fitting, and there's art in construction. And there's even art in understanding how fabric behaves and what kind of fabric does what and what you want it to do. So I like focus on sort of more traditional classic. I focus mainly on menswear. I've done a few things for women, but not much. And mainly shirts. I haven't conquered jackets yet. And it's taken me 15 years to just get to the point where I can wear something that I feel is like, you know, that fits and it hangs right.
But which is to say you do mostly for yourself. You talked about wearing them to work or whatever.
I make shirts for myself for work. I've made them for my partner. Yeah. I've made several for my father. Yeah. And I fitted a couple of family members.
Cool.
But it's in a very, as my partner says, it's like, it's also a very intimate thing. I mean, you're fitting someone and you have your hands on them, and you're kind of, it's sensitive, and people are sensitive of their space and their body and that, and you want to be very mindful of that. So it's best if it's someone who knows you, I think, ideally.
Which is so the opposite of how we deal with clothes, where, like, they don't know who's going to wear it, and it's the same thing that's being worn by thousands, millions of people.
Totally.
And this is just total the flip side of that, where you're literally making it for a specific person and, like, understanding their body and...
Yeah, and how they stand, and how they stand is a picture of what kinds of experiences they've been through in their lives. So they might slump over, they might slump shoulders because they've been taught to be compassionate and so they've internalized that to mean that they need to be, like, apologetic. So they have a curved posture.
Wow.
So you want to try to make them look good in that. So you've got to, like, fit the shirt so that it doesn't wrinkle when they stand that way. So that's a different thing, right? When you go to ready to wear, people have, like, you know, they have options that are based on this standard. It's like, you know, for menswear, a shirt is going to be like a 27-year-old who goes to the gym five times a week, who has, you know, 13% body fat, and, you know, and no, sleeps 8 hours every night, and, you know, perfect posture, and, you know, and that's who, you know, you should be. So you should put this thing on.
Would you say then that most commercial, or I don't know how to say this, retail commercial mainstream shirts are designed for models?
Yeah, I would say so. And a model of ideal physique.
Yeah.
Except in the U.S., where a lot of menswear that is geared towards older men has enormous a waist circumference and a chest, so for breasts and for beer belly. So, you know, if you go try shopping in the U.S. in most stores, like, you will pick out a medium shirt or whatever, you'll totally be swimming in it if you aren't someone who is overweight.
Mm.
So there's kind of like this weird thing where you feel, like, you feel a certain way about yourself when you wear this thing, and it fits you the way it does, and it's kind of showing you what, how you're failing to be a model, how you're failing to be that ideal.
Wow.
Where someone puts on a made to measure, not a made to measure, custom, which is even different from made to measure, you know, because it's fitted, as opposed to just taking measurements and then building those measurements. In custom, there's an extra step where you make a test garment from those measurements and then you put it on the body. So someone might have measurements that say that the shirt should look like this, but maybe they had a lot of hits in life and so they're slumped or whatever. They have scoliosis or whatever they have, and they're not, you know, their measurements say one thing, but their body posture is another. So you've got to make, you can adjust the fit of the garment based on that so that it looks as good as it can. And then you're making a custom garment for someone. And that's, it used to be how all clothing was made.
Hmm.
But it's not. It's not.
You mean all clothing was made for specific people?
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. You went to a shirt maker and had shirts made.
Right.
Okay. I mean, this is a long time ago. But this kind of mass production like thing is, it's grim, and it's so wasteful. There's so much textile waste in the world.
Mm.
Just filling landfills. People like Raleigh Williams, who've done sort of videos and talks about that, talking about textile waste and pollution from the garment industry. So I got into it through curtains, and that's my 45-minute answer to your question.
No, I was just fascinated to hear it, honestly, because I've never thought about all of these things in relation to clothes. Like, they are just kind of objects, and I just have them and move them around or whatever. So,
you know, there was a time, like, I've some shirts that I've been purchased commercially for me that say Jeff got me as a gift in the U.S., and I love the fabric, but it's, I'm swimming in it, so I'll take it apart and try to recut it so that it fits me better. And reassemble it. So in the process of undoing, like, if it's a good shirt, you know, there's certain standard ways that they're constructed. And so picking it apart, taking it apart, you can see the traces of the person who made it. You can, it's like seeing like an imprint. Almost like, for me, it's like an imprint of the presence of the person who made the garment. You can see the stitches they made, you can see the errors that they make, like we all make, and you can see, you know, they did this to cover that up, or this person was really good, and they did that to save some time, or, you know, you can tell that this person really had, this was really, really beautifully done, and sometimes you'll see all of those things in the same garment, because commercially some factories have a person only assemble a part of it, so they'll do like one part of the shirt, but they'll do like, I don't know, 700 of them a day. I mean, the mass of the scale of this is just, it's beyond belief. So when I think it, like, takes me 10 hours to make a shirt pretty well, and I mean, that's 10 hours, I mean, I am super slow, and, you know, but it's like a meditation, but you really learn to appreciate the skill in
can only imagine. I had learned to use a sewing machine very recently, and it was just to, like, fix holes and stuff. So I fixed a few holes in my own clothes, and I felt pretty good about that. Like, I don't have to, like, throw it out or, like, pay somebody else to do something. Which they're probably, it's not so lucrative for them to just fix a tiny thing. And so, but yeah, also a sense of agency of, like, I can deal with this, I can fix this, it's not just some abstract thing that I have nothing to do with. But then I forgot how to use the machine, and now there's a new machine around me, maybe, and I don't know how to, so.
Right.
But yeah, it's something I would love to know more about.
It's the kind of thing I find that there have been times in my life where I left it for a long time, and then you lose your skills, so it's unusual. Unlike music, which, for me, I think, tends to linger more. With sewing, if I stop doing it, I'll get rusty and I'll forget the things that I learned, and then I have to remind myself by messing something up and being like, oh yeah, I remember that.
I would love to share this with you about my musical experience recently, because I'm sure you'd have something to say about it. I told you I passed through Italy, and this pianist who did a masterclass like 10 years ago, I reconnected with him and stayed at his place, and he has this beautiful grand piano there and this wonderful bookshelf, and I felt super inspired just by the environment. I used my what I've learned in terms of managing my own nerves from guitar, just playing the guitar in front of people, recording myself, all of these skills that I've learned, somehow they do transfer for me to the piano, and I can actually play and I can manage myself and I can control what I'm doing, and there might still be mistakes, but there's somehow like I can work with them, I can slow down, it feels very malleable to me. So it feels good, and I feel like, oh, I'm enjoying the piano somehow, and I still actually know how to play somehow. I'm not like, it's not like I forgot. You were talking about just being rusty and losing skills. So I did this, and I recorded it for myself with this beautiful bookshelf in the back, and it's like, it's a wonderful performance, actually. I'm really happy with it, and it's just like a segment of the piece, not the whole thing, but it's just what I could manage, and this has now propelled me to do stuff on the piano, just and totally unexpected that I would spend my time here. Like, I always thought if I do connect with music from now on, I would just play guitar stuff, but like, oh, I actually feel compelled to like go to the piano and like practice a piece of classical music and try to memorize it and all these things that I was doing before, but with these new skills that I've learned from guitar and just to manage my nerves basically, and like I'm enjoying playing piano again. I have not forgotten how to do a lot of the things. Of course, there are some technical things that I will need to work more to achieve again, but like so much is there and so much is still expressive and natural despite all of the tension and trauma that might have been associated with all of that. And it's nice to actually feel free of those, of that baggage, and that also I've used my own resources in a way to make that happen. So I'm just fascinated with this. And so there's a few different pieces I'm trying to work on now. And so, I don't know. Have you heard of something like that happening? Or like what's
your reaction? All the time. And it speaks to my own experience as well.
Okay, yeah.
There's this point at which the skills that you've acquired need to be decoupled from the environment in which you acquired them.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard to do that, especially in an environment that values merging those things so that you play like this, or you play like this person, or you posture a status or a level based on how you play. And all of those things have absolutely nothing to do with expression of yourself. It has to do with you fronting a construct. And so this is why doing things that are not connected to the baggage of school or that kind of environment of skills and environment coupled together. This is why doing something like guitar in your case would have been very useful, because it's taking you out of that whole arena, that whole environment, and letting you focus on using the instrument as an expression of something happening inside of you. And so you have to kind of, sometimes it's necessary to do it through something that doesn't have the baggage, and then you can go back and re-engage it on your terms. And so that this speaks to a real problem, in my view, of how music is taught, and how expression is taught, how people are taught to be, to express themselves creatively. They're taught to express themselves inside of us, inside of a system that does not allow for people to be truly innovative. It creates, or even just free, I mean, it creates kind of shells of people who are not really inhabiting themselves. They're not connected to themselves. And it doesn't ever surprise me that that creates despair in people. It makes people unhappy and makes them, say, want to stop playing the piano, because there's no way to do it without they don't see any way to do it without being someone they're not.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things you had mentioned about the learning environment trying to merge those two things of like playing, like the skill that you learn and also the context in which you learn it and trying to merge that, I think it sounded like comparisons basically, like you must conform to this standard, you should play like this person, play this well, play,
yeah,
and this is kind of comparison. Of course it's an institution and we go there to maybe conform to a standard, like we are certified to be this way, maybe.
Yeah, well, there's many different ways that you can establish a standard. Say, for example, of performance optimization, you can set it through accuracy. You know, you can set it through a physical strength, balance, coordination. You know, you can attribute it to you can associate it with other constructs like emotional, mental wellness. You can say, you know, that's what optimization is, that you're sleeping and eating well and you're able to function, you're happy and you have friendships and relationships and family and you're like feel good and grounded and you feel optimistic about your life and you also play really well. But you know, that's typically not, that holistic picture is typically not what is taught.
It's not the goal, yeah.
No, the goal is to screw people into the ground and to staple them to the wall and sort of be, you know, and now it's like, well, where are all the creative, you know, visionary people of the past? And we worship all the greats and we ignore the geniuses in front of us until someone, despite all that, breaks out of it and does something really cool, and enough people say, huh. But a lot of the time, that doesn't even happen until those people have totally self-destructed, because it's so distressing to be taught all your life to conform, and if you don't conform, then to be taught you're a failure and a loser, and so then you flame out, and then everyone realizes you were really cool, but you're dead, and so then other people are making millions off of your misery.
Yeah.
And so shouldn't we do the same? Like, it's totally screwed up.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention is you just mentioned that sometimes it's necessary to just do something different to, like, bring yourself out of that baggage or that context. Like you said, in my case, playing the guitar separates me from all of those issues with playing the piano and gives me a chance to explore other ways. This is something
it gives you a frame of reference. I'm sorry. It gives you a touchstone. So you know what it feels like to do music, but to do it on your own terms and to do it from a place of inhabiting yourself more closely. And then you can transpose that because you know what it feels like.
Yeah. And I guess you sort of explained why that isn't part of the education, because the goals are different, right? It's not to do this, which is what you're saying, to help you, to give you a good reference frame so that you can so that you know what it feels like to do things on your own terms. I keep asking myself, like, why did it, I mean, I know the answer, but it's just a sort of wishing that it wouldn't have taken 5 years, 8 years, 10 years or whatever.
Totally.
And why couldn't it just happen faster? And also I'm reminded of this moment that I had in a improvisation workshop that I did after graduating. This was in New York, and I'm improvising, but like I'm not doing what I intended to do or something. And he said to me, like, if you don't want to do something, then don't do it. Something like this,
which is
it's a bit hardcore, but it's also right at the same time. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I guess I should just learn to control myself. But of course, what does that mean, and how do I approach that? I don't know. But this kind of thinking or approach, maybe I don't know if that's the approach that I could have taken for these other issues about nervousness while playing, but what is it actually that I do have leverage over in this kind of situation, and how can I make it take less time, or does it need to take all of this time, and do I need to really distance myself, you know what I mean?
Those get us into more cosmological questions, because they also, you know, they beg the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Why do things happen the way they do? And then we could talk about whether there is not to say that those things are good, that they happen to people, but that there are outcomes that can be, and that there's a reason that something unfolds the way it does, including all of the obstacles that are included. That's part of the life's journey, whether it's something predetermined or something that someone chooses or something, you know, before they're born. And, you know, then we're getting into a different kind of a frame of conversation. But, why did it happen that way? Maybe there was a reason to it. Maybe there's something richer, deeper, more meaningful, you know, that comes from that. I mean, one of the reasons that I ask these questions and we're having this conversation is because my mother died when I was a child, and I was traumatized, and I was sexually abused by a physician when I was a child. So all of these things were traumas. I'm not glad that they happened, but they've also shaped me and allowed me to emerge as a force that I think has had positive outcomes. So, you know, whatever the purpose to that is, or whatever the meaning of it is independent of the fact that it actually has created demonstrably positive things in people's lives, including my own. So the reality is that people can only be as conscious as they are. And so that goes for teachers, you know. And if you had teachers who were subjugated by their teachers and grew up in a system where they thought, well, here are your options, choose A, B, or C, and play like this, then that's going to be the kind of person they're going to be for you.
Yeah, of course, like, you can only do your best and use whatever's available to you, either as the student or as the teacher, and so you can't, you know, use something that you don't have there. But I wonder, like, is there something, like, if we imagine that somehow I received a message, like, from us speaking now to myself back then, and I could just say something that would actually be useful in that situation, like, what would it be? Or is there no such thing?
Well, no is a good one.
No.
No.
There is no such thing.
No, I'm saying that's the thing you could say.
I was saying no to...
If you say, yeah. I mean, because honestly, the beauty of what this teacher in New York told you, if you don't want to do something, don't do it, you know, that there is... It's easier said than done, but that is true. I mean, and everyone is good to remember that they always do have that power to say no. They may suffer consequences from that. It may not be something that won't cause destruction. I'm not saying any of those things, but there is that reality that we have, and I don't want to say that it's a choice, because I don't think it is necessarily a choice that people have when they choose, for example, not to say no. That it's like you don't say no, because if you say no, then you're going to get killed, or you're going to get destroyed, or your family will get destroyed, or you'll be destitute, or whatever it is the reality is. But there's nothing that doesn't allow them to say those words.
Sure.
So you're asking me, like, well, what is one thing I could have done back then that could have been, you know? So a teacher says, we'll play it like this, and you could say no. I'm not going to. And so we both know that would have had predictable outcomes, but chances are it is possible in this case that if you were someone who said those things, then you might have ended up in my classes sooner.
So this is just a pitch for your course, isn't it?
That's right, that's it. It's all, there's all the plan. I was telling you about strategy.
1-800.
It's all strategy. 1-800.
Good.
No, I'm saying that I tend to, the people who tend to be in those those environments of dissonance with their surroundings do tend to find me. I'm one of the people I think some people see as easier for them to maybe open up about some of the uncomfortable impositions that they experience.
So I suppose that, of course, not every environment has a Kevin, but if someone were to say no to something wherever they are, of course there might be consequences to that, but it is, I mean, maybe the teacher would ask them, like, okay, well then how would you like to play it? And then that gives, that creates a different kind of direction. Or, yeah, they get moved around to somebody who's not going to be too much trouble for them, and it just starts the process where maybe they just move in a different direction, I guess. So,
or they just usually they'll just subjugate. They'll leave. They'll say, "Oh well, this isn't for me. I'm going to go into law, or I'm going to go into something more sensible."
Anyway, I mean, of course, this is an odd question. I don't really try to diagnose the past in this way, but just something, I feel like it's a particular experience that we've both shared, and so it's something maybe we could approach in some way. But I'm happy and grateful to have what I have now. I can just say that. And looking forward to...
Well, you've created it. I mean, you've manifested it. I mean, you've it's come as a result of your temperament of agnostic observation. I've always admired that. I never really feel that you are especially attached to outcomes, that you are open to different outcomes.
Yeah, I think this is something I'm working on now, specifically this phrasing, even, I would say, like, don't be too attached to any specific outcome. Like, it's something I try to practice now, but obviously in the past, like, I have these ideas and, like, you know, I have this, I'm going to play this repertoire in a recital and then I'm going to improvise afterwards. And like, it's a vision and I try to go for it and maybe I fail, maybe it hurts along the way or whatever, but and then I would be disappointed because my expected outcome isn't what happened. So I've learned to just do less and less of that, but it's certainly something I'm practicing now, just to like kind of go with it and like, I even try to say, like, yeah, everything's fine. Like, if this happens, it's fine. If that happens, it's okay. I can... it's something I have to work on, I would say.
This is one thing that I really believe very strongly, and this is looking at process versus product, and that we get... It's one thing to have a vision of what your product's going to be. It's have a vision of the outcome. It's a very different thing to be rigid in... I use that term a lot, very kind of ossified and very stuck in your view of the outcome. So it's the difference between using imagination as a way to fertilize multiple potential outcomes, a vision or an approximate outcome, and another one to be like stuck in, it can only be that.
Some people say single-minded.
Single-mindedness, yeah. Same kind of thing. It's just sort of limited, or having your vision of that future artifact be one-dimensional, that it doesn't reflect the possibility for failure or discovery or falling in love with a different idea along the way and deciding that you're going to make something different. So the process then, if you feed your process with a vision of an outcome without being attached to it being a very rigid outcome, then you create more opportunity for interesting things to unfold. And that you're more engaged in the process. So you start with a lump of clay and you say, I'm going to make a tea pot. And then you start making your teapot, and then you take a break and you have lunch, and then you get food poisoning. And you're stuck in bed for a week and you have fever and you have hallucinations, and then you see an elephant in your hallucinations. And so you go back to your lump of clay and you say, I'm going to make an elephant, a teapot elephant. And you say, well, no, I don't really like tea. My grandmother made me drink tea. I hate tea. It seems I would make an elephant. But, you know, then, you know, the nose falls off and you say, well, this looks like a hippopotamus. So you start researching hippopotamus and then you say, I really, look at that baby hippopotamus, is so cute. I love hippopotamus. And then you have a dream that you're on an African safari. And so you get on a plane and you go, you bring your lump of clay and then you meet a hippopotamus, but then you fall in love with a woman. And then she has the most beautiful face and it looks a little bit like a baby hippopotamus, but you're completely in love with her. So then you make this lump of clay into this face of this woman. So tell me, have you failed to make a teapot? And so if you ask a potter, they will say, yes, you failed to make a teapot. Give this person an F. Yet the process is just immeasurably more important. And you've ended up with something that is so much more important, that has power and potency that is incomparable, because it belongs only to you and it's a reflection only of you, and it could only ever be. And so this is why you can start with a vision, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if it stops you from evolving, then that's when it becomes a problem. And by focusing on the process and letting it unfold in the way that it does, in the time that it does, then you are living in that magical dynamic space, which is where so much of the richness of existing as a life is.
I would say I have never imagined that I would be doing what I'm doing now. So in that sense, it's not that I'm realizing a vision of how my life should be, although it makes sense looking back, or even in the present, like, oh yeah, this makes sense to me. So I guess that means I'm trying to focus on the process.
You are. It seems that way to me anyway.
And yeah, I find it interesting you brought up this word power, which we were talking about upstairs earlier, and I'm curious how you, because I think what I do, like if I had to explain it to people in a familiar pattern, there's this phrase like doing what you like, following your passion, following your dream, like these kind of cliches that are tossed around. And like, yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of my time, and I'm fortunate to be able to do this, but yeah, I do things that I'm interested in doing. I surround myself with people that I'm into, and like, it's sort of doing your thing. So you describe power being in there somehow, and I've never seen it in those terms, so I'm curious to know what you mean when you say, like, Rosano has power living this kind of life. Because in many ways, I feel like it's the opposite of it, or at least in what we conceive of as power today, like money and status and...
Oh, those are different. That's what I would call control.
Okay.
So
what's the difference between power and control, and how do you see... you can use my life as an example, or you can use maybe something more simple.
Well, I don't think control is ever latent. So it's either something you have or you don't have. So, you know... If you don't have money, then you don't have control over, you know, how you live the way that someone who has money does. Mm-hmm. Or if you are at a lower level in a company, you don't have control over how policies are implemented or discussed or designed as someone who is in a C-suite is. So, you know, the... I mean, power is more often than not latent, in my view, unrealized.
So it's still around.
There. It's there, but it hasn't woken up.
Huh.
So it's asleep.
Okay.
Potentially. So it's, and power might be something that someone knows they have, and it might be something that they don't know they have. Both of those things are independent of whether it exists or not. It does exist. So everyone has power. Everyone. Every single person has power. That power can be subjugated by other people. Other people can try to push it down. They can fight it. They can pretend it's not there. They can create a world in which people believe that they don't have it and that they need to lean on other people and other systems in order to survive. Or they might know they have it but don't want to make waves, and so they don't say anything. Right? There's lots of people, I'm sure, in a lot of companies that have lots of ideas about how things could be improved, or that they see things going wrong or crimes being committed, for example, and they don't, they choose not to say things, but it's a sort of a gesture protecting themselves or whatever strategic reason they have. But it doesn't mean that they don't see those things, and it doesn't mean they don't know those things. It doesn't mean that wisdom isn't there, that intelligence isn't there. So power is very often latent. It can sometimes be actualized. When power is actualized, in my view, it tends to manifest in being able to control things. So if your power is actualized, you're aware of it, and you're exercising it, then you start to be able to shape your experience. You are starting to be able to control the experience around you. That could be either choosing to go this way or that way, or this job or that job, or
choosing to say no.
Choosing to say no, exactly, precisely. Mm. And, you know, the person who doesn't say no doesn't mean that they don't have the power to say no. It means that they don't say no because they have been either beaten down, or they're choosing not to say no to protect themselves in some way. So this kind of power, what I describe as power, is really is the potential for people to create experiences in their lives and control the environment around them.
It's the power is the power to create your own life, create the life that you want, create and the experience that you want to have.
Yes, and to shape the experience of other people, and to shape the experience of others, to create spaces for others to inhabit. You know, the big myth in music is that the best jobs are jobs that you find. And this is something, it's a kind of a line that gets, I think, fronted a lot. Whereas the best jobs in creative disciplines are typically going to be the ones that you create out of thin air, you know, and you.
And so, in that sense, creation is power. The ability to create is a form of power.
It can be an expression of power. I mean, the creative potential is aligned with power. I mean, because the expression of power is a creative process. Yeah. So, creating something requires that you exercise your power.
So I'm still, I follow what you're saying, and I think I'm still dominated by, like, in my thinking, just by this, I don't know if it's a popular concept of what power is, which you call control, but like if we say what you're saying to most people, that if you're able to, let's say, have agency and create your own life and do what you want to do, that's an expression of your power. Right. And everybody has power and they can use it. I feel like it's going to be met with this sort of, huh? Like, what do you mean? Like, right. No, they have power.
Right, exactly.
And maybe that's because they're defined in different ways, but like, how can we see this? I mean, it sounds strange to say, like, how can we make it sound more than just creating your own life? I mean, of course, but that's maybe the point for a lot of people to do that.
Well, here's the thing. The people who have control, individuals who have control, I think often have a vested interest in maintaining that control. So it's important for people to have, for people who have control, I think it's fairly important, it's fairly mission critical, that not a lot of people realize their power to also have control. So there's all kinds of systems in place to create a consensus that power and control are the same thing. And that, so it's really in their interest for you to think that way, because then you're not going to be a threat. you're not going to become the entrepreneur that's going to challenge their business model because you will have $3 billion and they only have one. So this is why people tend to feel comfortable in that embrace of individuals who say, don't worry about your power, let us worry about that. And here, just acquiesce, capitulate to the system, buy this, follow this template, follow this authority figure, don't question, don't ask those questions, don't have that frustration, don't think about it. So it's in the interest of individuals who have that control for you to say those, for you to follow what they set up for you, and to consume things, not create them, to be addicted to things rather than to enjoy them, and all of that. It's about creating an environment of being dependent, being less aware of your power, less connected with your agency, and less likely to cause problems.
It's crazy to hear this comparison of consumption versus creation, because you said earlier that creation is an expression of your own power. So if you, like I talked about feeling a sense of agency by learning how to use a sewing machine. Mm. Of course, it doesn't mean that I have to become a master at this, but just having that it gives me a sense of potency that, okay, I can manage this. And there are other skills that I can learn where I can also feel the same way. I think it's interesting to think that helping people to create is kind of, can just make them feel a sense of potency. Totally. Because they are exercising their, because they're realizing their power in this way.
That's right. They're tapping into it.
And also as a counter to consumption, like what I was trying to say with the sewing machine is I don't have to consume the service of somebody else. I don't have to buy another thing. Right. Like I can just deal with my situation, and that's powerful.
Yes.
Or it makes me feel powerful anyway. So I think that's quite profound, actually, just to compare those things. And maybe I guess I was asking in a way to figure out how, what are some bridges to think in a different way about this word power. And I think you're right to say that those who are in control are interested in making many people think that power and control are the same thing, so that you don't try to realize your own power, etc. So how else can we just unstick ourselves from that?
Well, first I want to make include a caveat here, because I think I don't want to imply that everyone who has control is exercising that control in any malicious way.
Sure, yeah.
But I do think that it is possible to be someone in control from a standpoint of wanting to empower other people and enable people to be powerful, versus subjugating other people and making them think that they don't have power.
Yeah.
So. But I also want to say that I think some people just are the way they learn to be, and that some people don't really even realize that they're doing that. I don't want to imply that everyone who creates a situation, an environment where people become subjugated, is being malicious and doing that, inflicting that on people consciously. Yeah. I think it's a propagation of a system that creates a cascading outcome that repeats like this. And I think that's what happens in sort of institutions where you have groupthink and people, for whatever reason, want to comply with the system and they want to play along and they have their own interests of advancing and want controls. Like a really good way to get control over something is to comply with the system that establishes who gets to have control. So playing along, if I speak in one way in my environment, I'm more or less likely to be given control over certain things, certain resources, than if I spoke a different way. So I might decide that I'm going to blend into this system or respect the expectations of this system in order to be able to have control, and then to change things, or then to. My approach has always been really to. I sometimes feel like a double agent or even a triple agent in my environment, because people who talk like I talk don't typically get into positions that I'm in, I don't think. Mm-hmm. It's seen as a little bit too strange or problematic, or and so it kind of came about organically, but it's sort of like I had people come up to me and be like, how did you get here? Like, how did someone like you end up here? And I don't always actually have that answer, but I mean, the reality is that you have to understand your context, right? So if you want to leverage more control in a situation that you feel is trying to make you not be in control, or trying to subjugate your power, then you can either be a total shit disturber, and you can be like, no, and screw you. And I mean, that has predictable outcomes, because it's to be like, well, this person, they don't even want to understand where we're coming from. And it, so you can find that by respecting the limitations of your environment, understanding where people are coming from, then you can deconstruct some of these obstacles a little bit more gently, more strategically, more compassionately. And
you call it strategies.
Yeah, like, it's a strategy.
Knowing your environment.
Exactly. It's a strategy. Knowing your environment, including knowing the biases of the people around you, knowing what their background might be that has caused them to be and see the way they do. And working around that, like navigating through it with a view to moving beyond it.
Yeah, what I call playing the game, or knowing how to play the game. Like, you can disagree with what's happening around you, or not be completely at peace or feeling in balance with the system that's around you, but know how to use it for your purposes. And
So there's two secrets to that. The first one is to understand the passion points of the people around you. So understanding what is important
in the environment. To them,
what's important to them. And the second one is having empathy for it. The second one is trying to see what they see. Trying to see something positive, anything positive about what it is that they're seeing. Doesn't mean that you have to agree with it. Doesn't mean that you have to absorb it. It means that it's this exercise in trying to understand where they're coming from
and what motivates them.
And trying to not be cynical about it. Trying to be agnostic. And saying, I see that they really, really care about that. And if you can communicate that you understand that, it eliminates very often the sense that of people being threatened, feeling threatened by you. Because they may not think you're one of them, but they also see that you understand where they're coming from, so they don't feel that they have to fight.
You're not a threat, really.
No. You might be, but you're not really a big threat. So it's sort of like, well, they get me. And the second secret is to understand that very often people who think they want different things actually want a lot of the same things. So let's look at Israel and Palestine.
Let's start simple.
So both sides want to feel love. They want experiences of love in their lives. They want the love of their families. They want the love of the people they love, they want to feel that. These are human things. It doesn't matter what side of the argument you're on. These are human beings. If you cut them open, and many people have, everyone's red inside. So don't tell me that there isn't common ground there. I mean, let's just cut to the chase. So everyone really does want the same things. Now, how does the problem occur? It occurs because of all kinds of other mitigating variables that can range from how people were taught to think, the passions that they hold, the convictions that they hold, the fear that they have to lose or to be taken out of those convictions, the rigidity that emerges through the process of inculcation into belief systems that make it difficult to experience the experience life through the eyes of another person. And this is where dispassion and hatred breed, because you don't see yourself as the other person. And so one of the big leverage points I've often found in approaching, engaging conflict and managing conflict has been to identify, is to present the thing that I want. If I'm pitching an idea or fronting a thesis, is to try to illustrate it in terms that the other individual has articulated that they want for themselves.
So you are able to say what the other person wants, and you know them well enough to know what they need, what's important to them. What
you understand, and you are empathetic to what it is that they see and want. You really understand it, but you also present what you want in terms that align with what they want. So with most conflicts, it is possible to find a way to find a solution where that can take place. The only time that it can't is if people somehow actually have made a decision, an actual decision, that they don't want to do that, that they don't want to see that, they don't want to look, they don't want to actually go there. Because it's not really a logistical place to go. It's an emotional one. You have to feel your way into this. You have to do it from a place of feeling.
And empathy. And empathy is not easy.
Well, empathy is, yeah. No, it's not. Especially when people have been hurt and abused and attempted to be destroyed. But it happens all around, on all sides, in every direction, all the time. So this is the thing that I think gets people stuck in arguments that are not about the actual argument. Like, a good therapist most of the time will say, I don't really think this is about
the dishes,
dropping the ice cream cone, right? Yeah. Or the dishes, exactly. It's not really about the dishes, is it? And moving someone outside of that space where it really is about the dishes. And if someone's going to tell you, no, damn it, it's about the dishes and screw you and I'm leaving, then there's nothing a therapist can do except say, I'll be here if you ever want to come back and talk about it. But if that's where you're at, then that's where you're at. And so that's where we're at. That's where we're at. And it and there's just nothing but misery and tears that come from that. Suffering and suffering on top of suffering on top of suffering.
Where did you learn to strategize and learn to see pieces on the board, let's say, in this way? More so in the previous context we're talking about, in the institution and...
It was being a church musician. It was working in church.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I'd say church, in my experience, from a social standpoint, tends to be really quite challenging and dynamic. in the way that personalities intermingle and the passions and the preoccupations that dominate people's minds, and in the feeling of the importance and the value of adhering to catechism and dogma, and the real blockages that can occur, and the eccentricity that can emerge in people, and the dysfunction, social dysfunction, the inability for people to articulate their feelings and their and to be constructive, I think tends, the church for me was a microcosm of that human drama, that human, those human dynamics. And it might have just been because that's where I worked, and this is might have happened in a school or a hospital or, you know, any other
group of humans trying to do this.
Yeah, because working in hospitals, for me as a musician, I've seen these same kind of dynamics playing out between, you know, anesthesiologists and cardiologists and neonatal people and surgeons and palliative care and who's on top, and the nurses and who's the RPN, the nurse practitioners, and all of that. It's the same thing.
It's normal.
But I learned it in church just because I think there was this element of virtue around compliance. So in a religious environment, in a religious institution, there's this idea that compliance and following and capitulating to control and forces of control is not just a matter of being a good person, it's a matter of like saving your soul. So it's like mission critical for people in a way to behave in a way that I don't think always plays out similarly in every environment. It's like your life depends on it. So I learned that kind of the way to succeed as a church musician professionally was to be very, very attentive to human dynamics and to focus on, as one of my mentors when I was a church musician said, you know, sophisticated interpersonal skills. And learning how to interact with a wide array of people who are balanced, to people who are unbalanced, to people who are obnoxious, to people who are kind, to people who are violent, and people who are toxic, and people who are not, and getting along with everyone enough.
Yeah. Without agreeing, without being cynical, but knowing how to.
Without agreeing, but being able to navigate and also to get stuff done. To present what it is that you want in terms that they have already said that they want.
If I could go somewhere random.
Yeah, please.
You mentioned once making a kind of Memex in the 80s or 90s, like kind of computer repository of knowledge. I think it was to help you write something.
Yeah.
Can you talk about like why you, maybe what that is, like why you wanted to do that, and like what you and how with the process of making that, like just.
So this was a database I made in my last year of my doctoral degree.
Music doctorate?
We had this really grueling exam series, comprehensive exams, which involved, you had to produce a bibliography of like 100 sources, and you had 5 essays, and then you were given 5 questions, and you had to write 5 10 to 15 page essays in 5 days. And so it was like, you know, 75 pages of writing in 5 days.
5 days, wow.
Which was a whole shitload of work. And I was completely terrified of this. And I thought, how am I going to do this? I remember when I started that degree, I'd sit in a coffee shop on the corner, and I'd look up at this tall building that was across the street that had about 15 floors. And I'd say to myself, if I were this building and this were my doctorate, sort of a symbol of like a ruler of my doctorate, like where would I be? What floor would I be on? And I'd be like, oh God, I'm on like in the lobby. And I was like, oh my God, I've got 15 floors to climb. And over the years I did that degree, I was sort of like, yeah, I think, you know, I'm like floor seven now. And I'm on a floor. But these comps, these exams were just terrifying to me. So I was like, I need to have a strategy, or I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to really ace these things. I'm going to do really well. I had a vision that I was going to like really succeed at this. I made a decision. I had been like a B student in high school all my life. And I decided when I went back to do my doctorate, I was going to say, I'm going to be a straight A student. I made this decision. I was going to be this person. Just, I'm going to be a successful person who does not say, eh, good enough. I'm going to be like, no, man, I really want to get this. I was like gold ring. I was like super like amped up. This is right.
And just to be clear, A refers to like not your own idea of a certain quality, but just like passing the test with this kind of mark or both? Or
like, well, I wanted to get like excellent evaluations on all of my schoolwork. Well, I made a decision when I went back to school for this degree, because I had 4 years between finishing my master's and starting my doctorate. I was 4 years where I was just working professionally as a church musician, and I recorded a disc, and I gave concerts and stuff, but I wasn't in school, and I went back to school because I said, I think I want to be a prof one day. I said, but I know, and I bet I'm never going to be a prof because there's no prof jobs, but I said, if ever there was a prof job that opened up and I didn't have a doctorate, I'll never have a chance. If I have a doctorate, then I'll at least have a chance. And that's why I did it. I said, I want to, if in case I win the lottery, I want to have the ticket in my back pocket. And that's exactly what happened. And you know, like, how about that? So anyway, the comps, this was the final, like one of the final steps in the degree. And this was like, you know, itself worth five floors on that building. I was like, oh my God. So as with most things, I was always really into tech, and I was always really fascinated by technology. I've always loved it. I've comes from basically when I was 7 years old, completely fascinated by airplanes, and I just love the technology of them and all of that. And I love, that's one of the reasons I love organ, because it's technological. Virtual organ has been a kind of an interest of mine. It's tech based. So I've generally found that with most things that I wanted to do in my life, there's some kind of technology tool that I can use to leverage to help attain this goal. And in that, at that time, I realized that there was this way I thought that I could maybe build this database that would allow me to really succeed with these exams. Yeah. So I thought, how am I going to like figure out what these questions are? I was talking to mentors, and they were like, oh, you're never going to be able to figure out what the questions are going to ask you. You just have to read these books, and you have no power, and all of this. Like, he meant nothing by it, but that's basically what he was saying, is that you have to just be anxious and suffer. And I said, no, well, no. So what I did was I said no to myself. And I said, well, no, crazy man, I'm gonna like make this work. And I thought, I know these people, I've worked with them for so many years. I know what they're going to ask me. They're going to ask me this kind of question, that kind of question. And I said, so I need to take notes in a way that allow me to retrieve permutations of topics. I need to find some way to, some switch system that I can create that I'll be able to retrieve these permutations no matter how crazy they are. So I took notes. What I did was I got a laptop. I didn't have a pot to pee in, but I bought this laptop. I spent all of my money to get this thing, and I got Microsoft Access, which was this database software, and I created these forms and I made them pretty, and I went through all of these hundred some resources. Every time I read through them, you know, skimmed through them, and found something interesting that I thought was going to be relevant, I made a note card. And after those note cards, I made a series of, I created a series of codes that would refer, like three or four letter codes that would refer, in capital letters, that would refer to the topic, some salient topic. So I would read some note and it would be like, well, this is like about influence in France and 17th century and organ registration, you know, sound, colors in the sound or whatever. And this article was about German ornaments in Bach before he was 25 years old. So I created like a series of codes that would indicate stages in this composer's life that I could reference. And this one was about Italian organ building in the 18th century, but the how it influenced France and all of this. And I did this for every single note card. I had thousands of note cards in this database, all identified, key identified with this. So then I started practicing writing these essays. So I would say, okay, I'm going to write an essay about Italian influence on French opera, you know, Italian organ building, Renaissance organ building influence on 19th century French opera. And I had a code for all of those things. So I'd plug it in, and this thing would go, and it would spit out.
Are these topics random? Like, or did you like just shuffle a deck or something, and you would end up with something like this? Or did you? Is there some sense to this combination of things?
Well, if I were asked a question, no, I started just by doing total random to see like how would it, and so then I would look at all these notes.
So you got a bunch of random prompts together, and then you wrote an essay on this random.
Well, this is how I prepared. I sort of said, so I said, I wasn't doing those test topics entirely randomly. I was working more on will. Like they're more likely to ask me like ornamentation,
right?
You know, Sweelinck as a composer, Renaissance, like sort of late 16th century Renaissance composer.
So you guided it in some way, but it's also basically there's enough variety where like you can't really write the same essay more than once, and then you just test the mechanism of like looking through these references and like compiling them, see what you can do.
Yeah, what happened was that it would spit out every note that I had taken that had those commonalities, and it would just filter them out. And then I'd line up all of these notes. I'd look at them all. I'd put them all, I'd copy them, and I'd dump them into a word processor. And they were completely disconnected, totally disjointed. Mm. But I would look and say, what are the connections between these various thoughts and ideas? And what kind of statements can I make? If I had to answer a question about, say, the genesis of a practice of organ construction, and I wanted to talk about how the music influenced that development or how they were mutually influential, then I would see in the notes that there were signs of how that influence came to germinate, mm-hmm. and what the context of that influence was and what the timeline of the influence was. So I was able, then I sort of arranged them in this kind of order, and then I started to see coherent threads of logic that I could argue through them with all the citations, because with every note card I had the note of the person and the page. I could put that resource in their hand, and I had footnotes and I had documents and bibliography and all of this, and this is absolutely clear, crystal clear. And I took those and I completely aced those exams, and they were like, how did you do this? And they were like, and I remember them asking, and they told me in my feedback for these comps, they said that some of these essays were actually publishable.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, I had anticipated some of these topics. So I had prepared, I said, it's really, really likely they're going to ask me about Bach, something about, you know, him growing up and what influence he had on, like, church music or something. So I, like, prepared, like, good writing using this database. And but was able to refine it according to the question that they asked, and I almost died that week because it was so much work to write this stuff, but it went really well. So that was like my secret weapon, and I still use that database today.
Oh, so it's current.
Yeah, well, I don't update it.
I mean, okay. You use it as a... put new notes into it, but you use the references.
I use the references because I have a student who asks me a question about Spanish organ. Like, where can I go to find out about, you know, improvisation in Spanish organ music? Yeah. And I need, you know, to ask them or a question I'm curious about myself. Yeah. I go back to it.
Did you tell them that this is what you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they said I built this database, and they were like, oh, I don't know what a database is or whatever.
Oh,
and
nice.
I mean, it was like 1997. Oh, sorry, 2003. It was 2003, and they were like, oh, he's just doing his computers. Computers aren't really all that useful.
He's doing this.
And it's all just monkey, whatever. And like they, and then at one point, my supervisor said to me, well, I have this colleague, like, would you mind sharing him your database? And I was like, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I said, I was talking to someone who's like, that's your research. Like, you're not just going to give someone your research and sort of.
Wait, how long did it take you to compile? Because you said you, I mean, you basically wrote notes for all of these books that you read and cited them. Like, that's not something you do towards the end of your degree because this thing is coming up, I imagine. You, like.
No, I did. I started it. I worked
like
on
you
it.
Must have read a hundred or hundreds of books or something.
Yeah, I did. I had to read about 100 sources. I mean, and you're not, and you had to, like, I got good at looking through documents to see where the stuff, like, where they're kind of rattling on, and you just keep skimming. And if you start reading scholarly work, when it's like good, your eye will stop on stuff that's relevant, and then you learn to sort of say, this guy is just telling me how fabulous he is, and I don't, no one cares. Next, and then you're kind of like going through it, and you stop on stuff that's important and cogent and well said. And so I would say I started this probably in August or September, and my exam was in April. It was a year of work, and I remember, you know, my partner was already living in Toronto, and so I would come and bring us sitting at the laptop, and I remember doing this stuff, writing my note cards and that, and then I started testing the database.
Yeah. I don't know if you're aware, but now this phrase, tools for thought, is a very big thing, and it's kind of a space, and there's lots of digital tools where you can take notes and link between them, and like, this is exactly the kind of thing I think people hope to accomplish with what's available now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's more consumer friendly, and it's like startup-y, etc. So I'm just like, I find it so curious that you were just doing this like in 1997, 2003, whatever, and like with Microsoft Access. And I'm sure you're not the only person to do that, but it's so functional, and it sounds, obviously, like you aced your exams, but yeah, like, it's one thing to just have a system like this and use it. It's another thing to just decide that that's what you're going to do as somebody who's not, like, a programmer necessarily. I mean, you say you like technology, so maybe you visualized this before you started and it was plausible and you just figured it out. But just cool to see someone go through all of that process and have it work. And you still use it today also, which is, like, another thing that we're concerned with about. Are your files going to be usable 3 years from now?
It's not ideal because I don't have that Access interface. I don't have any of those forms. I just have everything in an Excel sheet. I mean, that I just kind of, you know, Control F kind of thing.
Nice.
I mean, just to
whatever works.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't have it's not slick like the other thing was, where I had all these windows and that. And now, I mean, keyword searching is just so common. You just open a Finder window in Mac or whatever. You can do basically the same thing without any of that.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Oh, no problem.
That's great. Anything else you want to share?
Golly. I could talk. Me, I can talk forever and ever.
We can also just wrap
it up. As my sewing teacher says, every video he would end, his way of saying goodbye would be, and we continue. And we continue. And that's it. It's a wonderful way to think about ending. It's just onward.
And we continue.
And we continue.